we are going to take the indictment, evaluate all our legal options, and pursue everyone most vigorously. This is a case of political persecution. Had he not been running for office right now, for the office of the presidency, which, by the way, the polls have shown since this has been announced, his numbers have gone up significantly. Had he not been running for presidency, he would not have been indicted.
Former President Trump's lawyer, Joe Tacopina, speaking to CNN over the weekend. Last week, Trump became the first American president to face criminal charges. He's set to surrender tomorrow to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. A New York grand jury voted to indict him over hush money payments he allegedly made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels back in 2016. We don't know yet exactly what charges Trump faces or how many, but he's still running for president next year. So what political consequences does he face now? Here to talk about this is Karen Tumulty. She's a columnist and deputy opinion editor for The Washington Post. Welcome to Press Play, Karen.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So, as I said, the exact charges are still unknown, but we know legally this is completely unprecedented, right? I'm curious, though, from a political perspective, as someone who's covered U.S. politics for many years, do you think this is a pivotal political moment in any way? I mean, we've already seen so many GOP lawmakers just rush to Trump's defense.
I think it is really hard at this point to see how this plays out in the long run. It's pretty clear that in the short run, yes, the Republican base is going to rally around him. And if the Republican base is clinging to him, Republican elected officials are not going to be too far away. But I do think over the long run, you know, it's not a great thing to be constantly reminded that he allegedly paid hush money to a porn star. But there is, and we don't know what is going to happen to this case in court. The Manhattan DA is not only doing something unprecedented in indicting a former president, but he is relying on a sort of novel legal approach, falsifying business records, which is what we are assuming is sort of central to the charges, is normally a misdemeanor. It can become a felony, though, if it is shown that business records were falsified to either cover up or commit another crime. And what the assumption is, and again, you are absolutely right, we haven't seen the charges yet. The assumption is that they will be making a case that this was a campaign finance violation, which is a federal crime. Right. So, you know, a court may be sort of skeptical. Now, this is one of at least four investigations that
Absolutely.
Former President Trump
yeah.
has going. And this is, in some ways, the least straightforward.
Right. I mean, but as you alluded to, in the short term, it seems to have sort of rosies his political fortunes. His campaign says they've raised more than $5 million since news of the indictment broke last week. We've seen a recent Yahoo News YouGov poll showing a major jump in support for Trump among Republican voters. So do you see this as just a sort of further solidification of his existing base, or are we seeing any indication that Republicans who might have strayed from Trump are coming back home?
In the short term, there is a real rallying around him that could, by the way, kind of freeze the Republican presidential race in place for a while. But by the way, we saw something similar after the raid on Mar-a-Lago to get documents that the National Archives had sought from and that had been subpoenaed. So we've seen this before, and certainly, you know, Donald Trump is being indicted is unprecedented, but being in a jam is not.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, you talk to a lot of folks in the Beltway and beyond. Like, is there any sense among Republican, you know, consultants and folks within the party that they have to support him, but that they worry? Because this is, to your point, this has really muddied the waters for someone like Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is expected to challenge Trump in this primary. But at the same time, you know, this is just another thing kind of around Trump's neck moving forward.
And it also makes it harder for the Republican Party to do what most every leader of the party believes at this point, which is to move beyond Trump.
Yeah. So the plan is for the former president to surrender tomorrow in New York. I think many Americans are remembering what happened on January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol. Trump has called for protest. Can you talk about what we're hearing around concerns around security and safety in Manhattan and beyond?
Well, I mean, the law enforcement in Manhattan has had some time to plan for this, and they say they have. Who knows? But the fact is that Trump has actually been stoking the idea that his supporters should be out there protesting this, and he, as I wrote in a column last week, he increasingly is using literally apocalyptic rhetoric around his campaign. He keeps referring to it as the final battle, and that he tells his supporters, "Your retribution." I mean, this is biblical language. And so, if essentially what you're trying to do is convince people this is the end of the world, it does sort of create a permission structure for essentially anything goes.
Right. Of course. Very different situations, January 6th and what was happening in Congress versus this. Well, you mentioned there are several other investigations in Georgia over election interference into his handling of the 2020 election at the Justice Department, classified documents in Mar-a-Lago, some civil suits. Do you expect that we're going to see Trump in court quite a bit in the coming year leading up to the primaries?
Well, that is a good question. I mean, where all these other investigations are leading. And there is a danger here, I think, politically speaking, not legally speaking, that if for some reason this case gets thrown out of court for one reason or another, it really will sort of diminish the others in, I think, the minds of the public, that people will be more sympathetic to Trump's argument that this is, as he keeps saying, a witch hunt.
Well, we are going to keep an eye on all of that. That's Karen Tumulty. She's a columnist and deputy opinion editor for The Washington Post. Karen, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, normally we would invite Press Play's regular Monday legal analyst to talk about the charges against former President Trump. But since we likely won't know exactly what counts or how many he faces until tomorrow's arraignment in Manhattan, we're going to turn now to two other big legal developments this week. First up, the judge in Dominion Voting System's massive $1.6 billion defamation case against Fox says that lawsuit will go to trial. Jessica Levinson is Press Play's legal eagle and a professor at Loyola Law School. Hey, Jessica.
Hey.
All right. So quickly, can you give us a brief recap of what this case is about? What is Dominion alleging Fox did on air in the aftermath of the 2020 election?
Lied about it and claimed that Dominion rigged the election. There's some specific buckets here of statements. Basically, the statements include the idea that Dominion was somehow connected to Hugo Chavez. Yes, that is the late president of Venezuela. That Dominion paid kickbacks to politicians, and generally that Dominion rigged the election, the 2020 election, for President Biden by flipping votes. A judge has ruled that all of those statements are false. So Dominion is part of the way there, or a lot of the way there, actually, when it comes to this defamation case.
Right. I mean, in this ruling, which seems like a pretty significant setback for the network, the judge actually wrote, quote, "The evidence developed in the civil proceeding demonstrates that it is crystal clear that none of the statements relating to Dominion about the 2020 election are true." Crystal is actually in all caps in that briefing. I mean, how did he reach that determination?
So through the process of discovery, this case has been going on for a while, and there have been thousands of pages that this judge has looked at. There have been text messages that the judge has seen, depositions. And we all know, if we follow this case, that the evidence that it's come out so far is not good for Fox. There are statements where the hosts were texting each other or producers were texting each other saying things like, these claims about the election being stolen, they're nuts, or I can't believe that we're putting people like Sidney Powell on air, that basically this is all lunacy. And so when it comes to defamation, there are a few things that Dominion has to prove. They have to prove a false statement. And we have that here. The judge has said we have that. A false statement of fact. The judge also undercut part of Fox's defense here by saying, these are not all statements of opinion. They're fact or mixed fact and opinion. It has to be about Dominion, cause some reputational harm, and then here's what's left to prove. The statements have to be made with actual malice, meaning Fox knew or recklessly disregarded the falsity.
Well, I mean, you mentioned this distinction between what's newsworthy and factual and editorial opinions. And the judge kind of said, you can't have it both ways. You can't say this is a newsworthy fact and an editorial opinion. But a lot of what they've sort of relied on is this free speech defense, arguing that the First Amendment protected what they were saying on air. The judge wasn't buying that, right?
The judge was not buying that. And I think that's part of what makes this one of the most consequential cases when it comes to defamation law and the First Amendment that we've seen, frankly, in decades. Fox came forward with certain flavors of First Amendment defenses. They said that they wanted to use something called the neutral reporting privilege because they claimed we're just reporting on an issue in good faith about newsworthy people and newsworthy matters. And the judge said, no. This was not disinterested reporting. This was not in good faith. Fox also tried to come forward with the fair report privilege, saying, well, we were just reporting on official proceedings. And the court said that doesn't even match up with the timeline of, if you're trying to hook this to court filings, for instance, that doesn't even match up with when the cases were filed and what was said on air. So this ruling was really quite gutting for Fox. Really, there are just two things left. That Dominion has to show that the statements were made with actual malice, as we talked about, and there's still the issue of how involved Fox Corporation, the parent corporation of Fox News, was with the publication of those statements.
So a jury trial is actually already set for April 17th, just about 2 weeks away. But as you laid out, I mean, a lot of the facts of the case aren't really up for dispute. So is it possible this goes to settlement? It sounds like proving actual malice is a very difficult thing, even with these facts already settled.
That's right. I mean, it's always possible that the case is settled. Most cases are settled. But I would say in this case, it seems to be the aberration for a lot of reasons. I actually think that it will go to trial. And as you correctly pointed out, actual malice is a really difficult standard to prove. And that's in order for us to protect media corporations and protect others, to say that we have a really robust First Amendment in our country. But there are certain cases where, and defamation is one of them, we will penalize people for what they say or write. And I think the big question here is, again, what is the jury going to think when they see these text messages, when they hear the deposition statements, and when they maybe hear from Fox News media personalities and producers? Will they say, yeah, Fox knew what they were doing, or they recklessly disregard it?
Well, we will be watching that. Before we let you go, I do want to turn to another big legal story. This is in Tennessee. A federal judge temporarily blocked a law there that would have criminalized certain drag performances. And he did so just a few hours before the law would have taken effect. Quickly remind us what this law would do.
A lot. It would ban, quote, adult cabaret entertainment on public property or other places where it could be seen by a minor. And to people listening, if that sounds broad, it is really broad. And that's part of the reason that the judge temporarily stopped the implementation of this law, because the judge said, this looks like, and these are two big problems when it comes to First Amendment law, this looks vague and it looks overbroad. And that means that it looks like it will chill protected First Amendment speech. The judge said, if you want to try and do something like this, basically, you need to be a lot more targeted about this. Again, this is just a temporary decision. There's more to come, but big problems, at least with respect to overbreath and vagueness.
Right. I mean, it was challenged by this LGBT theater troupe in Memphis, and they pointed out in their suit that the law prohibits a drag performer wearing a crop top and a miniskirt from dancing where minors might see them, but not a cheerleader from doing something similar. I mean, how does the judge sort of responded to these arguments by the plaintiffs?
Well, and that's an argument that I think every judge hearing it will say, we potentially have something called a content-based problem. And if the First Amendment hates anything, it's content-based restrictions. And the example you used means that the law would target the message and the messenger. And that looks like government censorship. It looks like the government is picking winners and losers and who they want to hear from and who they don't want to hear from. And I think that's why the court was willing to put this on hold, both because of the issues we talked about before, that it's hard to know exactly what the law covers, and because if the law is allowing the cheerleader to engage in very similar behavior to the drag performer, then we have a content-based issue.
Right. We should say drag doesn't actually appear in this law. It's sort of danced around. Quickly,
yes.
This is a temporary block. Judge Parker agreed to delay the implementation for at least 14 days. What happens next?
So next, there'll be another hearing, and this is actually the second attempt at a similar type of law. I suspect that the legislature might have to go back again after the next hearing and try and create an even more targeted law that would fulfill the First Amendment requirements.
All right. That is Jessica Levinson. She teaches at Loyola Law School, and she is Press Play's regular legal eagle. Thanks for being here, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, Angelenos vote today on a replacement for disgraced city councilwoman Nuri Martinez, even as fellow councilman Kevin DeLeon survives a recall attempt. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. L.A. City Councilmember Kevin DeLeon survived a recall attempt last week. Fueled by the racist remarks in a leaked audio recording last fall that included fellow council members Gil Cedillo and Nuri Martinez. Cedillo lost his bid for re-election and Martinez resigned. There's a special election to replace her tomorrow. But DeLeon endures. He has refused to step down and now will likely remain in office until at least the end of his term. He faces re-election next year. Julia Wick covers City Hall for the LA Times and writes their LA On the Record newsletter. Welcome back, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. In terms of DeLeon's political career, I think almost every observer of LA City politics thought he was on borrowed time after those recordings leaked. How do you think he has survived this, and are you surprised?
You know, it's really interesting. Less than not even 6 months ago, it seemed highly unlikely that he would finish his term. There were deafening calls from his resignation, from essentially everyone from President Joe Biden on down, and equally loud threats to recall him from office. He made it very clear that he was not going to step down of his own accord, and his fellow council members cannot remove him. So really the only way for him to leave before the end of his term would be a recall. And what happened here is that someone who was sort of a fringe activist who had had three previous attempts to recall DeLeon before the tapes, launched this recall attempt, and no real organized effort got behind it, despite all of these groups kind of talking about wanting to recall him, and no other effort was launched. So this was a period of time that went, you know, they first signed their paperwork in October, and the filing deadline was Friday. So it took up quite a bit of time, and I think they've really run the clock out a bit on certainly the level of anger in the district, but also just the momentum too. It's really hard to collect enough signatures for a recall. So I think even if people were to start again, it would be really hard to achieve it.
Right. I mean, you mentioned Pauline Adkins, who was leading this recall. I'm curious, you said she's kind of a fringe activist and she's tried this before. Was there not sort of a coalescing of more mainstream, maybe more legitimate political figures to kind of support this? Like, do you think that's part of the reason it didn't get traction?
Absolutely. And, you know, there was talk of that. There was a lot of talk about what groups were going to lead a recall attempt. And then it just never really happened. It kind of petered out. And I'm sure there's more of a story to be told about what happened behind the scenes there. But the thing about a recall is you'd need about 25,000 signatures, including kind of a cushion for invalid ones, to succeed in that district. And so that's a huge amount of effort. It's either an army of volunteers or it's really, really expensive to hire people to go out and gather those signatures.
Absolutely. Do you have any sense like how voters in Kevin DeLeon's district feel about him? He's been a pretty constant presence on the ground there.
Absolutely. And I do think when all is said and done, kind of how he's handled this may get seen as kind of a masterful political strategy. Like him or not, he has managed to kind of get through this in a pretty strategic way. We did our paper did polling back in January, and that found that among registered voters in his district, about 58% would support recalling him from office, compared with 25% who would be opposed, and 17% undecided. So there certainly was support for recalling him in January, but he has been, as you mentioned, a constant presence in his district. You know, he's hosting raffles at senior centers. He's giving out food boxes, which, by the way, come with his picture and name on them. He's at ribbon cuttings for a new playground. He's everywhere. And he's really also, he's managed to get a lot of federal funding for his district recently. He's constantly documenting kind of everything he's doing for constituents on social media. And he's also someone who has, you know, had pretty deep support in that district before all of this. So I think he's really just focusing on his district and not on kind of the broader political attitudes towards him.
Yeah. And I mean, we should say he is a veteran politician. He used to lead the state Senate. So not a new face to a lot of folks.
Not at all. Exactly.
Before we move on to Nuria Martinez, any indication if he'll run again?
You know, I asked when we reported on the recall. He has not yet filed papers. And they didn't give an official comment on it. I mean, it's sort of presumed that he is until he says otherwise. And so that's sort of the kind of thing that I think no one could have guessed 6 months ago, which is that his biggest political challenge right now is re-election.
Wild. Well, there is an election tomorrow to replace Nuria Martinez, who was, I think, seen as many as the kind of ringleader on those racist audio tapes. There are 7 candidates on the ballot, another 4 write-in candidates. Is there a front runner in this race?
That's a really good question. There are, and my colleague Dakota Smith has done a lot of really good reporting on this, but there are 3 of the 7 candidates have raised significant amounts of money or are benefiting from significant outside spending. And those candidates are Imelda Padilla, Marco Santana, and Marissa Alvarez. And so they certainly are probably right now considered the most likely to make it to a runoff just because of resources, and they also have all been endorsed by at least one current council member.
Interesting. And do we expect this to go to a runoff, or could it be decided this week?
I mean, you never know, but yeah. I would be really surprised if, in order to avoid a runoff, one of those candidates would need to get 50% plus one of the vote. And to get that with 7 candidates is really hard. So I think this race very likely won't be decided until the June 27th runoff.
All right. Before I let you go, we also saw a conviction last week of former city council member Mark Ridley Thomas on bribery, conspiracy and fraud charges. There have been scandals and guilty pleas from other city council members, Jose Huizar and Mitch Englander, in recent years. Do you have any sense how voters are feeling about Los Angeles city government in general?
Not great, I'd say. you know, it's been a rough stretch. I think voters are really frustrated. I think they're disappointed. And I think there's a lot of anger toward city government and a lot of anger toward what they perceive as a level of corruption in Los Angeles city government. And I should say, by the way, that Ridley Thomas was convicted over actions that he took while a member of the County Board of Supervisors, not a city council member. But yeah. He then was arrested, indicted while on city council.
Yeah. Is it, though, like, I mean, it, like, again, as we said, there isn't seem like there's a very organized sort of response, that this is kind of public anger, but not a lot of stepping up by the political establishment to push back on some of these folks.
Well, one thing that I think is really interesting and where a lot of kind of the organized response has gone is into governance reform. Mm-hmm. So right now there is a big push at the city council level to change LA to have independent redistricting. Meaning the city council members themselves would not have control over the districts that they get elected in.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. We'll be watching that effort as well as these elections and other news. Julia Wick covers City Hall for the LA Times and writes their LA on the Record newsletter. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, as we celebrate hip-hop's 50th birthday, what a case involving Megan Thee Stallion tells us about who's historically been excluded from the culture.
They've always felt more like fringe conversations that were easily pushed off by the dominant voices of the, you know, quote-unquote culture, which is men.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brandt.
I'm a savage. Yeah. Classy, bougie, ratchet. Yeah. Sassy, moody, hey. Nasty. Hey. Yeah. Hacking, stupid, what's happening?
That is Savage, the first number one hit by the rap star Megan Thee Stallion. Her career is examined in the NPR podcast Louder Than a Riot. This season, it's exploring who is left out of hip-hop culture through sexism, homophobia, and misogynoir. The show was canceled last month, and its producers were let go when NPR announced major layoffs due to budget shortfalls. But the team has agreed to finish out the season, and it starts with the trial of the rapper Tory Lanez. Late last year, he was found guilty of shooting Megan Thee Stallion. She survived, and her career is still going strong. But the incident led to a messy tabloid spectacle that made us reckon with how Black women are treated in music and beyond. Joining me now are the host, Sydney Madden, and Rodney Carmichael. Hey, guys, welcome to Press Play.
Hey, thanks for having us, Marisa.
What's up, Marisa? Thank you.
Thanks for being here. You know, the whole construct of the series is really interesting, and I know you both have spent your careers covering hip-hop. In the first season of the show, you examine the many ways that hip-hop artists have been targeted by the criminal justice system. But Sydney, this season you've kind of turned the lens back on the genre and looking at who's harmed by the culture. What inspired this? How did you come to this decision?
First of all, thank you for such a succinct recap of season one. I feel like you just wrote a whole press release for us. Yes, copy. Yes, copy editing. Yes, as you said, season one was about rhyme and punishment, but specifically about the intersection of hip hop and the carceral state, the way it's railed against the carceral state and in some forms kind of reinforced notorious stories of infamy. But we wanted to expand what rhyme and punishment means in season two. And it's funny, timing is everything. As we were working out and putting out season one, that is exactly around the same time that Megan Thee Stallion was shot in July of 2020. And then we saw the residual abuse and the residual shots she had to absorb. And like you said, the tabloid spectacle specifically in hip-hop cultural spaces that she was enduring in the aftermath of this shooting, and that really became the impetus of our reporting. We knew that 50 years in, it was going to be a big moment of celebration for hip-hop, but we also see this as an opportunity of reckoning, recollection, introspection to make the future of the genre better and more equitable for everyone.
Yeah, and before we get into some of the other stuff, I mentioned at the top this concept, misogynoir. Sydney, this is this idea of a combination of racism and misogyny specifically against Black women. Can you just explain, like, where the term came from and how it differs from the general misogyny that a lot of us face?
Absolutely. So the term misogynoir, which is a mixture, mashup, and marriage of the words misogyny and noir, the French word for Black, and also a nod to film noir. It was coined more than 15 years ago by a sociologist named Moya Bailey, who we talked to in the opening episode.
So people can pretend not to know that misogynoir exists, but it's a farce. The evidence is there. And at this point, if you're denying misogynoir, then you're just denying reality.
15 years later, it's still a term that I would say is new in the public consciousness mm-hmm. and in our lexicon. But this case specifically revealed the misogynoir in hip hop in a way that had never been done before.
Yeah, it's such a good descriptive of the specific type thing. And I'm wondering, Rodney, like, are you all worried about backlash? A lot of the things you're tackling in this, season are kind of taboo within the rap world. And, you know, they're challenging a lot of the legends of hip hop, their songs. It's a departure from the first season.
Yeah, it definitely is. Just because a lot of these issues are so divisive within the culture. But the fact that they are is really like the best reason for exploring them more, dissecting them more, interrogating, you know, the amount of misogynoir that continues to proliferate throughout hip hop. Yeah. So much of the culture is kind of built on the commodification of women and the marginalization of women and queer artists, queer folks as well. And a lot of that, you know, comes from larger culture, larger American culture and Western culture. But this is also a celebration in large part of all of the people who have, you know, risen despite all of that. You know, there's so many. I mean, Black women are running rap right now.
Yeah,
that part.
ain't no mistaking that, you know. So
for sure,
we got to acknowledge that. We got to talk about that. And we got to celebrate that, you know. If anything, that definitely deserves to be celebrated in 50 years into this genre.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about the trial in a second. But sticking with you, Rodney, for a sec, I know you have kids, and like, I'm wondering how you think about talking about kind of this duality. And, you know, you love hip hop so deeply, but obviously, we don't want to be perpetuating some of these harmful stereotypes into like the next generation.
Yeah, no, that's such a good question. You know, I have a 3-year-old son, and I have a daughter who was born while we were working on this season.
Wow.
And for me, it was really my son that I think about most when I think about this question, because when it comes to figuring out how to snuff it out, it's about dealing with us, the men, you know, who perpetuate it, you know, from generation to generation. And just thinking about that, first, really just thinking about my love of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just natural for you to want to share your love with your kids, you know, as you become a father. And although it wasn't the first time for me really starting to grapple with the ways in which the culture hasn't always dealt with the misogyny and violence that's built into it, this became a bigger moment, I guess, a bigger moment for self-reflection, because it really became a moment of me starting to think about my ideals as a man and how they were shaped, and acknowledging that a lot of them were shaped by hip hop. Right. In a lot of ways, hip hop raised me. A lot of my favorite artists raised me, you know, when I was a teenager. And I think that this season, you know, is just as much as an opportunity for the men that are listening to be thinking about the ways in which we've been complicit in terms of allowing misogyny within the culture.
Yeah, and as women, probably about how we internalize that. So, Sydney, you both, as well as your producer, attended that 2-week trial where rapper Tory Lanez was ultimately convicted with shooting Megan Thee Stallion. And you all seem pretty blown away with how explicit the misogynoir was on display at the trial, I know, in the defense, but also sort of the reaction outside the courtroom. Can you just talk about what that felt like being there? And was it, I don't know, worse than you expected?
In terms of what it felt like being there, I will say to see the ways that Megan's reputation became the center of conversation around this trial, so much so that she was being painted by Tory's defense to be abusive and alcoholic and deserving of some type of violence. There was even points where he even tried to backtrack on the agreed upon fact that she was shot. He would use air quotes a lot. We saw the x-rays of bullet fragments that are still in her feet, some of which are still in her feet to this day. To see all of these facts laid out and to see it mangled and misconstrued and misogynoir be weaponized to kind of muddy the waters of the facts was incredibly hard. So I do pause to say that any of it was shocking, because it was, but it was also like real regular. You know what I mean?
Right, like exactly. It's like shocking and exactly what you expect at the same time.
Exactly. And we do unpack that very specifically. That milieu of emotions of like, wait, why am I shocked? Gabby, our senior producer, who was also helping report out the trial, when we talked to her about unpacking and processing the emotions of what it took to do this, she said something so succinct. She was like,
it was so easy to be terrified and then be like, "Why, girl, why are you caught up? She's a Black woman, first and foremost. And this is how she will be treated."
It's these things that are so ubiquitous in the culture of hip hop and in American society that they don't even get explained anymore. They are considered rules that are cemented in hip hop, and that if you break them, you will be dealt with, you will be punished. But they're really reinforced by the status quo of not speaking them out loud. And this season is about saying those quiet parts out loud, very much so.
Absolutely. I mean, Rodney, she mentioned the rules. That each episode kind of has a theme. And the first one is this idea that being exceptional doesn't make you the exception. What other rules are we talking about? Like, and how did you guys kind of settle on those as you work through this the season?
Yeah, the rule structure just became like a really kind of shorthand sort of headline way to really boil down the very specific form of marginalization that we were talking about in each episode. We really wanted to like boil down and break down what was happening. And so when we talk about body policing and the male gaze, which is the idea that, you know, the way that women are seen in society, but also specifically in hip hop, is all through the lens of what straight men want to see. That image becomes the predominant image that women are judged upon. We talk about the BBL explosion, especially in hip hop, which maybe maybe your listeners won't all know what BBL is.
They can look it up. They can look it up.
Right. They can do their Googles.
Yeah, they can look it up.
Yeah.
No doubt. Which, you know, has contributed to a lot of body negativity, right. I guess is one way to put it. And in a lot of ways shows how they're breaking and going against and challenging that rule, which is the cool thing about the season. In every episode, the person that we're profiling is a rule breaker. You know, it's somebody who's come up against whatever this particular rule, this misogynistic rule is, and they're pushing back against it. You know, they're challenging it. They're breaking down the wall. They're shaking the table, and they're really showing us what the future of rap looks like, and maybe even the future of society. You know,
I wonder, Sydney, at the end of the first episode, where you guys are talking about the trial, Rodney says that the Tory Lanez verdict won't change anything in the culture, and Starting with you, Sydney, like, do you think that's true? I mean, and do you think that if he had been acquitted, that it would have sent a different message or changed anything?
Let me answer the first part first. Yeah. I mean, he's right. And we've seen it already. Like, when we dropped this episode, there are people all up in our mentions still debating whether or not it was Tori who shot her. Some people even still saying, asking whether or not she was shot. This is going to continue to be a very divisive case, unlike anything else that hip-hop has ever had. In terms of what this is going to mean for both Megan's and Tori's career, respectively, and how people continue to see them, specifically Megan, I should say, like, this is going to have a lasting effect on her career. Yes, she is a talented, influential, top-of-her-game artist. People are still going to drag her name through the mud. I think back to one of my favorite artists growing up, because it was one of my parents' favorite artists, and that's Tina Turner. Tina Turner, once she said in one interview that Ike Turner was abusive to her, that became a recurring question in every interview for the rest of her professional life. Like, this...
They made it about the man. Yeah.
They made it about the man. Right. So that's really the reckoning that we are trying to engage with in an intentional way.
Yeah. I mean, especially given, like, she's the more famous, successful musician here, you know? It's like, that's why we all know his name is because of her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we are talking about this, right? This is not a conversation that was happening when I was growing up, you know, in the 90s. And I feel like this is a more honest, raw look at it. Like, does that give you some hope that at least these conversations are starting?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's our intention.
Yeah, I think this is a conversation that has been happening in hip-hop pretty much since its inception. People have pushed back, and as we say in the episodes, like, there have been rule breakers. That's why we have even points of progression at all, to the point where the girls and the gays are running this rap game. See, I didn't curse. This rap game. but they've always felt more... like fringe conversations that were easily pushed off by the dominant voices of the, you know, quote unquote culture, which is men. Right. So I think as hip hop has become the biggest cultural, like, influence and cultural export from America, we're starting to see it at such a magnified level that it's become undeniable.
Well, thank you both for shining a light on all of this. It is really well told, and I encourage folks to check it out. Thanks for talking with me today.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sydney Madden and Rodney Carmichael are the hosts of the NPR music podcast Louder Than a Riot. You can listen wherever you find your podcasts. Coming up, we remember Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto, who wrote electronic music, film scores, and more, and was a regular on KCRW. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lago, sitting in for Madeline Brandt. It's hard to imagine that the same composer of this heavy, minimal, haunting theme for the movie The Revenant is also considered the godfather of electronic pop music. Ryuichi Sakamoto, who passed away last week at age 71, straddled genres much like he did continents. He started as a member of the electronic music group Yellow Magic Orchestra in his native Tokyo. You're listening to a track of theirs called Firecracker. He then became a solo artist, wrote Hollywood film scores, and composed music for the Olympics. He was a guest on KCRW many times. There's a photo of him in the halls here, eyes closed, deeply engrossed at a piano. Joining me to talk about Ryuichi Sakamoto is Tom Schnabel, a longtime KCRW DJ and the host of Rhythm Planet. Hey there, Tom.
Hey, Marisa.
Tom, you interviewed him twice, first back in the 1980s when he was new to America, and then again in 2010. KCRW really championed Sakamoto. What are your thoughts on his passing?
Well, it's sad. I mean, we knew he was sick with cancer and he wasn't getting any better. So it is sad. But we have so much to remember him by, so many different facets of his musical personality. He was a classically trained pianist. His favorite musicians were Debussy and Takemitsu. So he was steeped in both the Western tradition as well as the Eastern tradition. And then, of course, in the 1980s, Japan was like this huge, you know, power player and whole technology and everything else. With Kraftwerk, he got into the whole technical, the whole sort of techno side of music, too. So he was living in many different worlds and had a really fascinating way of composing and making music.
Absolutely. I hear you recently discovered that you both also shared a hatred of restaurant music.
He wrote a piece. There was a piece in the New Yorker where he talked about going into restaurants and hearing the awful music, you know, the algorithmic music that you hear. And I just laughed my head off because I have left restaurants because I can't stand listening to this. I can't have a conversation. And he said exactly the same thing that I was thinking in the New Yorker. And it just cracked me up.
It is pretty funny. I mean, not the restaurant type, but fusion music is really what he's known for, right? Blending different styles and influences. I mean, what do you think about most when you think about his style?
Well, I know Yellow Magic Orchestra, YMO, of course, was the technical side, you know, the sort of the techno side of him. But I like him for his piano playing. And I like him for the smaller scale stuff. The record that he did in Jobim's home in Rio is a beautiful example of the intimate side of Ryuichi Sakamoto and what a good piano player he was. You know, so it was just perfect. I mean, there's a very Brazilian side of him as well.
Well, he didn't just fuse styles and genres, but he also was really good at fusing his style with other musicians. What are some of the collaborations that stand out to you?
He collaborated with Yusu Endur, which I had sort of forgotten about, but that's a pretty far-out collaboration if there ever was one. He did a lot of work with the English singer David Sylvian, who started with a group called Japan, and Ryuichi Sakamoto and David Sylvian worked a lot together, and I love David Sylvian's voice. You know, his work with Sakamoto was just absolutely beautiful, and they did a lot of things together. And then, of course, there was the soundtrack side of Ryuichi Sakamoto, which actually, for me, sort of interested me less than his own albums.
Yeah. I mean, as you kind of alluded to, the foundation of his music was classical European music, but he also, you know, world music was part of it as well. And I know he said if he hadn't become a musician and composer, he would have been an ethnomusicologist. Do you think that speaks to why he was so malleable across different kinds of music and collaborators?
I think he's a musical polymath, but I think he listened to all different kinds of music, classical music, jazz music, world music. I mean, it's interesting. When I was in Japan, I went straight to Tower and I went to HMV store. They had more albums and more CDs in there than they have here. So, I mean, in terms of living in Japan and having access to all this music, you know, it was all there, and certainly a lot more there than here in the States. He knew about that, and he was a musical sponge. He took in lots of stuff. He did tell me about music that he hated. Let's see, where did I tell him? Wait a minute. He said, yes, I said, what kinds of music are you most interested in now? And this is from my interview in Stolen Moments, my book. And he said, now, well, all kinds except Hawaiian music and country and Western music. And then he started laughing. So there were some things that he didn't like. And that always makes me laugh.
Perhaps easier to say what he didn't like than what he did like, since it was so broad. You know, he won an Oscar for composing alongside David Byrne, the score for the film The Last Emperor. And he also did a little acting opposite David Bowie in the movie Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. So two famous pop musicians in a movie set in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. It's pretty wild to think about now.
Well, he had another side to him. He was not a fashionista, but he was such a beautiful man, all the couturiers wanted to clothe him. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, he had all the latest French fashions, and he was a fashion icon as well. So he had, you know, he had this. I mean, he couldn't walk down the street without people, you know, sort of being all over him. And I don't even think that happened to David Bowie when David Bowie lived in New York. He was kind of anonymous. But Ryuichi Sakamoto was very well known and was a fashion icon as well.
Tom, any other memories of the time you spent with him?
I asked him, I said, if you had to produce a dream record with famous artists that can be either alive or dead, do you have any idea who you would choose? He said, wow. And then he said, okay, I would like to use Jimi Hendrix for guitar, maybe Bill Laswell for bass, and maybe Sly Dunbar for drums, and maybe the horn section from Sly Stone. I could have artists like Coltrane for solo parts and strings from the Berlin Philharmonic.
Wow.
yeah, that's a wow. That's a wow. And that's who he was. Amazing.
All right. Well, I wish we could listen to that on our way out. But instead, let's listen to a bit of the score for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Tom Schnabel is a longtime KCRW DJ and the host of Rhythm Planet. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tom.
You're welcome, Marissa.
That is going to do it for Press Play today. I'm Marisa Lagos. I'll be filling in this week for Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.